Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 305. And we're live tonight on Odyssey, DLive, Rumble, and Entropy. Please make sure you share this show because it's going to be a good one. And you might be thinking, where is Thomas Sewell? Well, I can tell you this now. We've been chatting for about 10, 15 minutes. He's just making himself a coffee, and he said he'd be back in a couple of moments. He said, do you do an intro? I said, yeah. He says, do you mind if I grab a coffee? Because I think there for him now, it's about 6 a.m. in the morning. So obviously, I appreciate him getting up at that time to do this show. So don't worry, he is here. I'm just doing the intro. Now, I've got a couple of things coming up later in the week. I'm live with Dr. David Duke at 4 p.m. on Friday. I'm also doing a little pre-recorded video. It's only a short one because I've been very busy with the baby, as you know, and all the other stuff. And it's about how quickly demographics can change. It's actually about a borough in London that went from majority white British to white British being about 10% of the population in just two decades. So that's like about a generation is all it took for the white Brits in that area to go from being the majority to being a very small minority. And not even the majority minority, as they call it, where, you know, the whites are a minority, but they're the largest group. You know, whites weren't even the largest group in the borough, Bangladeshis were. So anyway, that's coming out on Friday. Then on Sunday, I'm having another Australian on. I'm having Joel Davis on. Now, Joel and me have been talking quite a bit recently, and Joel wants to discuss his essay, his sort of debate he's been having with Keith Woods via a series of essays about National Socialism. And he's very passionate about this. And I'm doing a bit of an interview saying, can National Socialism be salvaged? And is it a relevant ideology in the 21st century? And that'll be with Joel Davis at 8 p.m. on Sunday. So that's going to be a bit of a sort of an interview, not really a debate, because, you know, I want to hear his point of view. I am going to put some searching questions to him, and that'll be about a 2-hour show, but that'll be an hour later than usual, 8 p.m. on Sunday. So if you want to hear Joel Davis on why he believes that National Socialism is still relevant and can be salvaged, and why he thinks it's important, I'm going to be showcasing that on Sunday at 8 p.m. So that's what I've got planned for the rest of the week. Now, if you like this show, if you like the work I do, if you like the fact that I never give in, I never cook, and I'm very, very consistent with my output, even when, you know, my son is born, I'm here on a show with you guys, please do consider dropping a small donation. $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford, whatever you think this show's worth, whatever you think my work in the movement is worth, please consider supporting me, because nothing goes behind a paywall, and I have never, ever charged a penny for any of my work. Everything's always been free. And obviously, tonight's going to be a big interview, so if you want to ask questions to myself and Thomas in the second hour of the show, you can do that by dropping a super chat, and any paid super chat, you know, we will read out in the second half of the show or ask relevant questions from the audience. And as I said, you can donate on Odyssey, you can donate on Entropy, and we'll read those out in the second half of the show. And it all goes to a good cause. Anyway, let's introduce tonight's special guest. It is, of course, Thomas Sewell. Now, Thomas is from Australia, and he is one of the most famous Australian nationalists, and the state have come down hard on him for that. He has stood on a very, very firm platform. He has never cucked. He has never given an inch. And he has kept fighting despite the incredible state oppression. He runs the National Socialist Network. They are a very active protest and advocacy group, which also helps young males with their self-esteem and fitness. They do a number of very, very provocative protests, but they've been gaining a lot of support. And as such, the state are coming down hard on them with some of the most draconian legislation that Australia has ever seen, something that brings Australia in line with the likes of Britain and Germany with hate speech laws, and even jailing people for raising their right arm. But this hasn't beaten down Tom. He still leads the group. The group keeps on growing, and their protests get ever more provocative, and they will not be beaten. So, Tom, how are you doing this morning? It's morning for you, evening for us. I hope you're well. How's things going down there?
Yeah, we are engaged on all fronts. So we're keeping very busy. We are doing a lot of background work at the moment because of the lawfare we've encountered. So our first objective is to maintain the organization momentum, but we're definitely in the trenches. So I like to compare it to maneuver warfare. And this is obviously not endorsement of any paramilitary strategy. Just the notion that you can study politics and you can study war, and you'll find that they're basically the same thing. And I think most of the people in the audience have a quite almost autistic understanding of World War II history, and you know, the Blitzkrieg or maneuver warfare. They have an understanding that you know, the First World War was a failed strategy, the idea of trench warfare and trying to bleed the enemy dry in this kind of sense. It's not an effective strategy if you have a smaller economy than your enemy. And that's what the Germans figured out pretty early on in the war, in the First World War, hence the Second World War, when people were able to be mobilized, so to speak. You saw these very, very deep penetrating warfare, maneuver warfare movements. And I think that we need to take that strategy to politics. I think we've always taken that strategy to politics, even if we've used quite vocal and almost abrasive terms to most people within the general public. That is what penetration does of the psyche, because politics is really about penetration of the psyche. And I believe that the conservative model is trench warfare. I believe that they don't want to take ground. It's too dangerous to take ground. Because the enemy's too established in their position, and they need to just hold ground. And you can never win a war or a political conflict by just defending, by just holding ground. Obviously, we've seen the conservatives concede and concede and concede by an enemy that is just innumerable and has a better fighting spirit than the conservative weak right. And so we're trying to get mobile again. We're just currently in the trenches. But it's okay. There's always time to consolidate and work out your logistics and move forward. But I think we've got about 34 court cases at the moment that have built up over the last year or so. And this is obviously the main system of the state to bog us down. The spring will come, you know, the snow will melt, the mud will clear, and we'll be on our way soon. We've just got to win one crucial court battle to get things back up and running again. And that's going to be the most important, but not actually the most expensive. We've actually had a lot of really expensive court battles over the last 3 years, but we need one critical, a Wunderwaffe, like a wonder weapon to get us mobile again, which is going to be in the High Court. So that's what we're working towards. And that will free up a lot of our organization to continue operating the way it is and the way it's winning and the way we're taking ground, the way we're penetrating through and shifting that Overton window. We are the fighters on the right. Well, I'll be careful with my language. You know, we're streaming in Britain. But we are the political movers on the right versus the political trench warfares on the right, the conservatives. And we're actually the movers. We're actually shifting the line. And that's why they want to tangle us up in the barbed wire. So, yeah.
Well, I've got to say, I do agree with your analogy. And one of the books I recommend people read is The Art of War, because I think The Art of War is directly applicable to politics. I would say that and Machiavelli's The Prince are two books that are very helpful to outsider politicians. Now, one of the sort of tools that you guys use so effectively is you are a small group, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, and you punch well above your weight. Now, obviously, ethno-nationalist groups are usually small groups because most normal people are quite scared to be involved because of the repercussions, and it takes quite brave men to be involved in a cause like this because you stand to lose an awful lot by being involved in this cause. I mean, I know you have personally been harassed by the police, and you face incarceration regularly. But one of the things I've got to say is you guys, you punch well above your weight. And with the use of your sort of provocative rhetoric and your provocative protests, you get noticed and you get far more publicity than a lot of maybe larger in membership terms, but more milquetoast groups. And I've seen people in the past criticize groups for doing this. One of the guys historically that got criticized for this approach was George Lincoln Rockwell. But as Warren Balog said the other week, people today are still talking about George Lincoln Rockwell. He's still a guy that, you know, inspires people to this day and still inspires people in the media even to write articles about him, even though he's long gone. And you guys are treading that path now. But arguably, times are far more oppressive now than they were in Rockwell's time. Now, when you do get these media blitz moments where everybody's talking about you, is that something that you're sort of really gunning for? And how does that affect the organization? Are you bringing in a lot of young blood from those articles?
We're getting a lot more support from the wider community, from conservatives that are switching sides, that are switching strategy. They're starting to believe that we do need to have pushers and movers and shakers on the right, that we need agitators, that we need a far right, that without a far right, we can't have anything that we want, even if we don't agree with everything that the far right agrees with. But what I've often found with a lot of these supporters, for example, for every 100 people that contact us, probably almost 90 want to support us. They reach out because they want to support us. They want to be involved in a political party, or they want to be involved in some sort of, pay a little bit of money, get a little pin and say, thanks, guys, I've done my job. They want to just send a present to the home, they want to send a little present to the front line, so to speak, the political front line. They don't actually want to go sit in the trenches with you and work out how to take ground. But about maybe 10 out of 100, probably 10%, are actually keen to get involved and join. And honestly, they come from all demographics. They come from all demographics. For every 18 or 21-year-old that we recruit, we recruit a 44-year-old with 3 kids. So that's something that we never used to have. And we're seeing the movements. We're seeing men that actually have something to lose, realizing that this isn't just the strongest horse, but there isn't actually an alternative. And if we don't start building the manpower at this level, we're never going to see change in this country. So the other conversation, I think you asked about getting in the media spotlight. Our objective isn't to get in the media spotlight as much as it is, because that obviously helps shift the Overton window in on of itself. It's not spotlight for spotlight's sake. Like, I know that's not what you're suggesting, but that is sort of what some people suggest. A lot of our critics in the more moderate right, they just say that we're just doing this purely to get attention. And that's not actually how politics works. We're doing it so that we can present as the only legitimate opposition to the system, because the system is obviously a uniparty. And when people are watching the television, the system is agreeing with each other on everything that is, important for there to be an opposition. There is no opposition when it's a major subject. And then the left and the right disagree on things that are irrelevant, things that are minute. And we are trying to not just bring ourselves into the picture, but bring those important conversations that are being avoided by the mainstream parties and forcing them into a position where they're defending an indefensible position, whether that be drag queen story hour, like this tranny nonsense, whether it be mass immigration, whether it be, laws against free speech, by forcing their hand, by forcing them to react in the stupid and silly and overconfident ways that they have, they lose legitimacy way faster than we gain 100 members. And that's a hard thing to measure. And that's what a lot of people, on the tactical level, they don't understand about the strategic level. They think, like, we've had some rallies where things haven't gone to plan. People have been a little bit upset afterwards. And, morale has been low. And what I've said to people is, don't worry about where your morale is right now. Like, you guys have done a good job. We got this message on the table. Give it the next couple of weeks. See the news articles that come out. See how the system overreacts, overplays its hand. See how the public, even if they don't support us, because in the early days, the public didn't support us at all. They do now. but they didn't support us at all in the early days. But what it did was it made the public not support the regime. And that is more important than getting public support, is making the public turn against the regime, because regime legitimacy and regime support is at an all-time low. And obviously, there needs to be an alternative. But alternatives are often built in vacuums. They're not often, like, serious alternatives are built in vacuums. You can only really build a vanguard. You can only build that spearhead. You can only build that very small formed body of volunteers in the early days when system legitimacy is really high. And so attacking the system's legitimacy is actually more important. Making the system attack its own legitimacy is actually far more important than, 15 seconds of fame. But we've had so many segments of 15 seconds of fame that we are starting to become, household names or even folk heroes to some people. You know, we're the Kelly Gang, we're the agitators, we're Eureka Stockade, we're the Aussie Battler, we're the underdog. And a lot of people respect us and a lot of people recognize us in the street. And our allies are growing and are numerous. And a lot of people are jumping ship from the regime to support us in our attacks against the regime. Our political attacks against the regime. So we're in a struggle for our survival. And I do also believe that fame is important. I do also believe that the spotlight is important. If the spotlight's not on us, who's it on? And and I'm sure most of the audience are also concerned about the ever-growing presence of bad faith actors that the system is building in a lab. We see them pop up on Twitter all the time, these nobodies that have never done anything, that have never built a group. They don't have any community behind them, and they don't have any media experience by the looks of it. And then suddenly the algorithm is putting them in everyone's feed, and they've got 300,000, 500,000, 700,000 in such a short period of time followers on social media. These people are very concerning because these people are obviously part of the regime trying to, not necessarily bait and switch, but the regime trying to transform and mutate and synthesize our talking points to then redirect them back into, ultimately, obviously, if it doesn't appear right now, ultimately back into system legitimacy. And the greatest of all time, in my opinion, is Donald Trump in that regard. He absolutely perfected dog whistling our talking points and continues to do things and say things in the immediate that are in white interests, but then very quickly he works out a way to mutate them into Jewish interests. So that's also why fame is important, because if they're talking about you, they're like, if America had a obviously there's some guys rising stars like Thomas Rousseau, for example, but if America had a genuine right wing alternative over the last 15 years, you would find that I mean, there was some guys, and certainly they were put in prison, unfortunately. As we know, that's what the system does. If they see someone of high value, they put him in prison a lot of the time. But yeah, Donald Trump wouldn't have found his feet so easily, I think, if there was an established right-wing alternative the way there are in European politics. But with the Uni Party and with it being 49-49% Democrat-Republican, that's America's in the most dangerous situation with that to continue to occur. And our goal has to be in Britain and Australia to transition more into those European-style politics, to attack system legitimacy and let other people fill that vacuum and then see where we're heading, what our timeline is.
Well, I think it's really interesting what you're doing in another sense as well, because the left have always been very, very successful in that they've always pushed boundaries. So the left have got where they are, not by towing a line, not by being polite, not by accepting their enemies' arguments or playing by their enemies' rules. The left have created their own rules and they've pushed every single boundary as hard and fast as possible. Now, on the other side of the political spectrum, the sort of quote-unquote right has largely believed that if they tone down what they say, if they play the game, if they adhere to the left's playbook and the left's sort of language rules, they will be more acceptable and be more successful as a result. And this has tended to lead to not just sort of punching right, but it's tended to lead to a fragmentation on the right where you have groups that are closer to the sort of conservative centre spending more time attacking groups to the right of them rather than what the left do. So the left, you know, have the centrist left groups, but they actually support groups to the left of them because they realise that the groups to the left of them are involved in the same tug of war and pulling in the direction they want to go. And I think the NSN really is sort of one of the leading, if not the leading group in the Anglosphere now for pushing the argument as far as it can go in the direction that many conservatives have given up on. And saying all that, as a follow-up to this point, would you say that you get more attacks from the left or more attacks from establishment conservatives? Because I often find that when someone does raise the issue of radical ethno-nationalism, or as you guys do, national socialism, often more attacks flow from the sort of centrist conservative right than they do from the left.
Now, I don't have a solid answer for you on that one because it changes. It does change. We do find that the center-right often has a strategy of asphyxiation where they refuse to talk about us. They don't want to acknowledge their competitor, so to speak, for space in the right. But and you'll find that the left establishment will attack us constantly. But then sometimes it changes over. The left get their act together and they start ignoring us and they start actually taking their own advice, which is asphyxiation. And then what you find is the center right have a habit of attacking us again from the position that we don't love Israel and these are evil, they're bad for the Jewish community, and for they'll attack us for social cohesion because they don't want to necessarily use the word far right extremists. They obviously have to frame the argument against us differently to how the left frame it. And so what they're doing at the moment is they're saying that we are. We're bad for social cohesion, and we have to protect multiculturalism because these people are bad for social. They're troublemakers. I think the opposition leader, who's soon to be prime minister, said that we were losers with no friends and that we're awful. And that was really interesting because we have a lot of friends. We just don't take Jewish money like he does. So we just have different friends. Our friends are all people that care about this country. His friends are all people that want to destroy the country. So everyone's got friends in politics. But what they mean is obviously that we are, we're not a system approved ideology, and therefore they should be discredited. But the problem with that rhetoric coming from the system is that no one likes it anymore. It's unpopular. It's never been so unpopular. So calling us the outsider is actually playing into our playbook. And I think they know that, but they're just ill-disciplined. But yeah, in short, to answer your question, yeah, we get attacked from, I think, both sides equally. I don't really keep track of it as well as I probably should because I'm just focused on destroying their legitimacy and focus on building ours.
Well, one of the things I've noticed of late is around the world, in every white country, there now seems to be a huge divide, which is largely being pushed by the Trump Musk regime. So Trump and Musk have, you know, captured Twitter, and they are now saying that you can be a nationalist on Twitter as long as you are not openly an ethno-nationalist and as long as you support Israel. So genuine radical groups such as NSN, Patriotic Alternative, the NJP, when they were active, Patriot Front, they've been completely taken off it, the Nordic Resistance. There have been almost every genuine radical group. There are no radical groups in the UK still allowed on Twitter. They've been completely cleansed. And it seems to be that this new, you know, Elon Musk era of Twitter is almost as censorious as the previous one, but previously you had to play by the left wing rule book, but now you have to play by the sort of Zio right, pro Israel don't push it too far, Rawback. It's not genuine free speech. And I was appalled when all of you guys lost your Twitter accounts, because people like Joel were blowing up on a daily basis there. And I noticed one thing that was really interesting. Every time you guys got into a debate with an Australian politician, even if that went right to the top, like the, you know, the Prime Minister, you guys were completely destroying them. And there seemed to be a very, very positive reaction, especially from young males in Australia, to the policies you guys are pushing. And obviously, you know, I watch, strangely enough, out of all the political shows that are on, you know, social media, I actually tend to watch you, Joel, and Blair the most, because you're on at about 10, 11 o'clock my time in the morning. So I'm always sat at the computer working there, and having something on to listen to is always great. And you guys are always on. And, you know, listening to the strides you made into that sort of young, disaffected, white male sector of Australian politics, which has been completely neglected, was amazing. But how do you feel now moving forward without Twitter? Do you think that's going to limit you to a large degree?
Yeah, it's limiting us a little bit, but we were getting ahead of ourselves. So apologies for those that don't like the Blitzkrieg references, but we pushed so far into the enemy territory. We dragged that Overton window so far across and had so many successes that we were running out of supplies. And so in my perspective, it was, Adolf Hitler says there's always a silver lining. You know, every defeat can be turned into a victory. And I truly believe that. If you actually look at what the universe is asking of you, or God, then it's very clear that we were stretching our supply lines thin. The structure of our organization needed to be addressed. Our recruitment needed to be addressed. Just the management of the organization as a whole, we were evolving into that next stage where we needed to develop more junior leaders and more people to manage region reps and stuff like that. And this is where our focus needs to be for the first half of this year. And obviously all the legal cases and having clarity. We couldn't just keep doing what we were doing. If we did, we would have ended up, I mean, I think I gained about 20,000 followers in about 2 or 3 months. And so I went from getting my account back. I think there was 9,000 followers on it. And because obviously I had it for a short period of time last year before it was deleted. When I got it back, I was smaller than most of the Australian politicians. And within 2 months, I was much larger than most of the Australian politicians, with far greater reach, despite the sort of tenfold, they've got like a tenfold. I noticed that, you'll get about 10 times as many likes as you do views, in proportion to other accounts. So that obviously that nerfing or that bottling of the reach, I was still getting far more reach than all of these, Mark Dreyfus and James Patterson and, you know, Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese. Like, some of them are senior people within the Australian government, the ones that are writing the laws to have us locked up for destroying them on Twitter. They were just getting absolutely pillaged in their supply lines. They had no support. All of our support was mounting. And the public that's on Twitter, which is probably hundreds of thousands of Australians, they were loving it. They were enjoying it. They were loving it that someone was sticking it to the man, so to speak. And even though we're not on Twitter anymore, that doesn't really matter, because we pushed so much for now. Obviously, next year, it might be good to get back on Twitter. And that ties in with some other logistics issues that we've got to deal with. And I think registering as a registered and recognized political organization within the Australian Electoral Commission will give us a huge advantage in terms of maintaining our social media, because then you can get that government check mark. And that's something that I think Twitter would have a very hard job at censoring. Once you're technically recognized as being part of the government, even if you don't have any MPs or senators, but to be an actual political, a registered political organization, which is just something that we're looking at over about a 12, 18 month period. We've got some other things to deal with first, but then we'll get to it. But as I was saying, because I can still go on Twitter, I can't like anything. I can't, you can't see my account, but I'm still on there just viewing occasionally, probably too much, because I've got a lot on my plate. But what I've noticed is that you have not just disaffected young white men on there. You have a lot of middle-aged men and women. You have a lot of grandmas. You have a lot of mums and dads on there with their full name and their profile photo, echoing our talking points almost to the word, and becoming political commentators on their own without getting shadow banned because they're not on the government register of naughty boys or naughty girls. And they're getting, in some cases, 10 times the reach that we're getting just as average Joes and without a political organization, but building up a huge social media profile. And their talking points are spot on. And they're calling out, you know, the fact I just looked at it this week. Australia brought in 200,000 Indians this month for student visas. Obviously, they're all returning back to university, so that's going to be a big influx this month. But I mean, I think it's been 700,000 since last year, and or since the last season, or however it works. But I'm seeing figures pop up. I'm not looking too hard at the exact nitty gritty of it, but I'm seeing 200,000 in a month, 700,000 in a year, and the Australians are just going wild over this. This is insane. And none of the political parties are looking to do anything about it. And what I'm seeing in the comments section from basically everyone in these threads, not NSN members, not radical far right extremists, I'm just seeing from everyone saying mass deportations. And so that's what we were on Twitter to say, and people are saying it now. So we've broken through the enemy lines, and the trenches have now caught up to us. And I said that about Drag Queen Story Hour. No one in Australia protested Drag Queen Story Hour until we did. We did it a couple times, and then we never needed to do it again because the conservatives, or you know, the center right and these alternative right wing people that are still within the realms of the mainstream, they started holding that ground for us. We took the ground, they hold the ground. We take the ground, they hold the ground. That's it. That's how it works. We are on the offense. We are offensive. We go on the offense. And then these people fill in the ranks and they bolster and they hold the ground. And that's a position that's never going to shift now. That trench where the center right is at in Australia, where the average Australian person is at that doesn't feel that they identify with the Liberal Party or Labor Party, which is our two major parties, where they're, and probably most people within the Liberal Party, but they're probably quiet about it, where they believe right now is that mass deportations is not, it's not a debate. It's not negotiable. And then the system is coming out, especially the Premier of New South Wales, who's an idiot, which is the biggest state in Australia, New South Wales. He's come out and said that freedom of speech is incompatible with multiculturalism. And that's why you're not having it. You're not allowed freedom of speech. It's incompatible. And we choose multiculturalism and social cohesion. And so you're not getting your rights back. And that is just the fucking, you know, a lot of guys in our camp have been saying, Chris Minns must be our guy. He must be an accelerationist. You know, he must just be an infiltrator within the system that's just crashing and burning the Labor Party and the Liberal Party, the Uni Party, because that is the dumbest fucking thing a politician could ever say to a bunch of white people. And it just shows how out of touch they are. Obviously, it has consequences for political activists, as we are all aware of. Senior political activists and senior spokespeople are going to bear the brunt of these laws. People like myself, and Jacob Ossant and Joel Davis, and potentially even people like Blair Cottrell and a lot of other guys that are periphery to the movement or periphery to the organization, but deeply within the movement. And, you know, I don't think we're at British style laws yet, but we are definitely one step closer. We are definitely getting very close to those British style laws, which, again, gives us time to go back to the drawing board as to what our strategy is going forward and what's our left and right of arc. Because as you said earlier, our objective has always been to put forward the most radical lawful position. What is the line in the sand? Where is it? And let's go right up to that line in the sand and test their nerve. And we've done that quite successfully with only a couple entrapment operations, only a couple of us going to prison. And we're out of prison now. And I'm sure there's more prison time to do, unfortunately. But that's not going to stop us, is it? Because we're going to secure the existence of our people. Yeah.
So if you guys did pursue elections, would you be pursuing the elections with the goal of winning, or would you be pursuing the elections with the goal of getting yourself into potential TV debates or town hall debates where you might not go out there to win, but you go out there to upend the system and to shift the Overton window? Because I'm not sure whether the world is ready quite yet to vote, you know, for the majority of people to vote for a group like yours. But I do think people would turn up at a town hall debate in greater numbers because you're there. And I do think you would be the ones that, whether you won or not, you would be the ones everyone was talking about. And I think there's a, I think it's sort of like when David Duke stands, you know, David Duke stands and, you know, he knows now because of the demographic shift that it's very unlikely that he wins. But when he attends a debate, he knows that the numbers watching are going to be boosted by sort of 20, 30% just because he's there. And his talk of, you know, Israel, where American money goes, AIPAC, you know, Jewish control of the media, by raising those issues in that way, in such a sort of public spectacle, it does shift the Overton window. So would you be going out there to actually win, or would you be more going out there to sort of hijack the whole process and really upend the political system in your own way?
It's a very good question. And I think that any leader, any organization should be honest with its supporters and with its members so that they know what they're getting into. And I don't think that you should start any process without that honesty. And you shouldn't start any process, I think, without the intention to win. We have to have an intention to win. Now, what does winning look like? Now, that is another question in itself. I believe that it is possible for significant change to happen within the parliament system, but ultimate change is not possible. And so in the past, I have echoed the talking point, the very radical talking point, that there is no political solution, which is often misused and misunderstood by people that are edgy and angry and online. But what that really means is that there's no ultimate parliamentarian solution. That's kind of the fine print of the subject. There is no political solution. Obviously, the system itself, the regime wishes to conflate that statement with one of illegal activity, which it isn't. That's not actually what that statement means, even if it's misused by a small percentage of people. What no political solution means is that it's mostly a statement of motivation for people to realize that Parliament does not change society. Society has to change so that Parliament changes. That the solution to the problem is to change the culture, the political culture, to then impact Parliament. And so many people are focused on the political party route, and they're thinking that, oh, if we only we election harder, if only we hand out more leaflets, if only we, and they're working harder, but they're not working smarter. They're kind of stuck in the political factory mindset where they're in the factory and they're building. I've worked in a steel frame factory when times were tough, and it's probably not the worst job I've ever had, but it was the lowest paying job I ever had. And, you know, when I first got doxxed and I was in the factory and you know, screwing off thousands of screws a day into these steel frames to build prefab walls. And no matter how fast you screw off those frames, you're not getting out of poverty. It's not possible. You are stuck there. You have to think smarter. You have to work smarter, not harder. You're never getting out of that poverty once you're there. So that's the same mentality that a lot of, that's the mentality that people need to understand when they're getting involved in party politics, is that it's not about electioning anywhere near as much as it about shifting the culture and attitudes of the society, which your running for parliament is meant to be only one small component of. And so I have dedicated, I have stated to my cadre, to my core members, that yes, we are building a political party. No, we are not changing direction. At the absolute maximum, 25% of our resources is going to be going towards this project. The majority of our resources still needs to go towards this overused term, metapolitical shift. And what I'm much more focused on at the moment than building a political party, despite the fact that it's the news everywhere that everyone's talking about and everyone's saying, oh, you know, what's this political party going to look like? What's it going to be like? And, you know, when are you going to launch it so I can sign up and be a member? What I'm actually focusing on more than anything is aesthetics. Aesthetics. I believe that the right wing, and this is a little bit of channeling the esoteric Bowdenism, but we need vitality. If the pro-white position, if the National Socialist position, if fascism, if radical nationalism, if whatever we want to call it, it's irrelevant to me in some ways, but I think fascism is a pretty cool brand. We need to make a brand. It's the brand power. It's the staying power. It's the aesthetic power of delivering a worldview through visual, through spectacle. The great masses of people, they know in their hearts that we are endeared to Australia. They know that we care about this country and we want the best for everyone in it, but they are caught up in the spectacle, in the bread and circuses of modern political culture, 21st century boring left versus right political culture. And what I'm focused on more than a political party is how do we bring vitality and vigor and strength and aesthetics into the political conversation? Because to me, most people already agree with our talking points. So we don't really need to educate them much to support us. And on top of aesthetics, there needs to be a way of interpreting the carrot and stick dynamic into the political arena. And so we are mostly stick as a political entity, and yourself as a political entity. A lot of people on the street may support us, but we think it's just stick. They just think it's fascism, it's authoritarianism, or it's radical nationalism, and we're just going to start beating people with sticks in the street, and they're just going to be like, well, they don't hate me, so they're not going to beat me with a stick. That's why I support them. And it's like, what is the carrot? What is the carrot? And there has to be a balancing act of that. And that's why for what we're trying to do with the launching of the political party or the policies is trying to have a balancing act between carrot and stick. So that's very important to us. And the last point that I'll make on the subject is you asked me about what is going to be our sort of goals with making the party within the political system. And what I'd say is that those goals are ever evolving. Of course, the goals initially in launching is to show people that there's an alternative and to maybe, you know, rabble raise and cause enough stir that we can get one or two guys in the Senate. We're not going to be getting any MPs anytime soon. And it would be delusional to think that we are. We have to have a rational approach to it. It'd be good to get one guy in, even if that takes us 5 or 7 years, that would be difficult. But at least we've got a representative, and we can keep focusing on what our actual metapolitical and community building, and you know, white fortressing, and everything else that we're doing. All of these projects, the culture shift, the aesthetic shift, the active club shift, all of these things are so absolutely crucial. And then the middle goal would be to be the tiebreaker, and that's the term that a lot of people are using. That worst case scenario, all that we're ever going to be able to accomplish over the next 20 years is be a tiebreaker. That's the sort of realistic worst case scenario, that we could probably get a couple seats and sort of like what the BNP did and get up to that sort of 7%, maybe 8% total population. And that's best case scenario. But that 7 or 8% could be a massive tiebreaker and help shift Australian politics into a more dynamic and fluid European style politics, where 8% is actually a really big party, where 8% could be the third or fourth biggest party in the country. Well, I think at the moment, 8% would be the third or fourth biggest party. But ideally, that 8% would come from smashing the centre parties. And there would be a lot of 8% parties. That would be the ideal scenario for us. And then forming not coalitions of ideology, but coalitions of convenience, to ally with other smaller parties to be able to vote against and take away power from the Uni Party. Because we can't have any parliamentary change until we smash the Uni Party, until we smash the Centre two parties into a million pieces. There won't be any parliament change because they're just too powerful and there's just too many of them. So our goal shouldn't be necessarily immediately to try to take power. Our goal should be to take away power from those that currently have it and to introduce a little bit of chaos into the system. To create the vacuum that can be filled later. Yeah.
I agree. I think part of what we do has always got to be taking a message to people that's going to provoke a reaction. Now, you want two reactions from people. You want the people who like you to be cheering and the people who dislike you to be wailing. So you make the maximum amount of sound possible with what you do. Now, something else that we do is we do a lot of legal work. We do a lot of advocacy. We do a lot of help with young men. So this week I helped a young guy who's been struggling to get a job. He's been in the doldrums, but helped him with a CV. This is something that I do regularly and help people with sort of training for interviews, for going for a job. We do legal advocacy, and we do a series of different sort of training seminars, helping young people with life skills, things like that. And I think that one of the things that's missing amongst the white community, well, firstly, we're not a community, but as soon as we stopped being a community, there stopped being a support network. And I think that something that we do here that I'm particularly proud of is providing that support network. So Patriotic Alternative has already helped this year with several legal cases, one employment tribunal and one other legal case. And we're always doing this to help people who've been discriminated against. Do you think the National Socialist Network will get involved in that kind of advocacy as well? Or is that something you're already doing?
We're already doing it a little bit on the side. So we have something, we have a similar tribunal. It's called the Fair Work Commission for when guys get doxxed and lose their jobs. So we're always providing basic administrative advice for how to guys to engage in those processes, because it's obviously, you know, unjust and improper for someone to be fired for their political views. And often they get a good result and they get a little bit of a payout. And then, you know, but the process is the punishment. You know, they've lost the job in the industry they actually want to work in. I'll preface this whole conversation with what I've been telling my junior leaders as of the last sort of 9 months, which is that their main trade is politics. What I've been teaching my guys, the guys that are region reps and sort of little branch reps, is that this is actually long-term their trade. So whatever you're doing for a job, whatever you're doing for your career, whatever your trade is at the moment, whether you're an engineer, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a dentist or a doctor or a plumber or a carpenter, regardless of all those things, you need to be starting to transition over the next 10 years or 5 years, depending on how high you up within the organization structure. You need to be starting to think, well, I'm doing 40 hours a week hitting nails into wood. How many hours a week am I learning statecraft? Because what we need to do more than engage in party politics is actually build a shadow government. We need to build an opposition government. We need to build a government, not a political party. And that's what I've always told people, that we are currently engaged in the endeavor of building a political party. But from day one, we have been engaged in building a government. And so a government provides services to its people. So obviously, an intelligent white nationalist organization or ethno-nationalist organization engages in some sort of quasi-government service with its people, and it needs to be balanced. It needs to be balanced, you know, stick and carrot, or that's probably not a good term for talking about your own people. That's more talking about the wider population that doesn't really get it yet. But it is important to balance. It's a very fine balancing act between the feminine and masculine forces of politics. And the feminine forces, I think, of politics, well, that's one way of looking at it. You could divide it as feminine or masculine, or you could divide it as fighting and logistics. You could look at it from the perspective that the Taliban are the government in Afghanistan at the moment. And they obviously had people fighting us, fighting the Australians, fighting the British, fighting the Americans. In open warfare. But if you look at it purely from a political perspective, a lot of their success was the fact that they actually controlled vast swathes of the rural society. They governed over that society before they governed over the cities. And when we have the so-called fall of Afghanistan and the Taliban rule as of 2020 under the late Trump and Biden administration, what we're really seeing is not the Taliban take over all of a sudden nothing to everything. We're just seeing them take over the cities. They already ruled the countryside. They already provided services to the countryside within their own rule book. What they perceived to be the rule of law through obviously Sharia, they then implemented that on the fake astroturfed Afghani liberal democracy that was never going to be able to be sustainable in Afghanistan. Because it's not fake. It's fake. Sorry, it's not real. It's fake and gay. So likewise, our people need to have a sense of loyalty to our mission based off the theoretical, which is, the ideas space. But unfortunately, well, not necessarily unfortunately, but the reality is that that's only a certain percentage of politically effective and politically active and politically thinking people of all different ages and also male and female, men and women. But the average Joe is thinking more in terms of services, more in terms of not what I can do for the state or for the folk or for the government, but what the government or the state or the nationalist organization can do for them. So it does have to be a balancing act. Obviously, our main disagreement, which we don't need to get into, is that I ban picking up rubbish, for example. But I will change my policy on that when we actually have a suburb. When we have a suburb and when we have a town and when we have a park that we visit all the time, and we actually have a sense of community, because we don't, like as white people, there is no white national park. There is no white public hall or public park or anything like this. When that occurs, I will change my policy on obviously keeping our streets clean. I do think that, and I do like what you guys and Patriot Front have done in terms of disaster relief. And we actually, for the first time ever, did a little bit with the storms up in Queensland. Not this time, but I think, both times. So last year and this year, there were some storms in Queensland and some of our guys. We didn't promote it as much as maybe we should have or could have, but we're not looking at this stage to over inflate our sense of community service, because we're not doing that much community service. We are focusing on the political first and community service in the background. But yes, yeah, certainly an expanded answer as well on the subject of a legal lobby and on lawfare. And every organization that wishes to succeed in this game, yours, mine, Patriot Front, needs to have multiple wings, multiple arms. And I do appreciate the way that the British, that yourself and others have focused quite heavily on building the infrastructure, because every country, every white country, doesn't just need a white vanguard, doesn't just need a white political force or metapolitical force, but it does also need, because what is a metapolitical force? It's a way of achieving a political goal without the just the direct and obvious route of parliamentary politics. And so everything is political power. And that's what I tell people. A petrol station or a service station is technically political power. It's meta-political power, but it is. Like, investing in your own community is a political action. Building a political lobby group is political power. So we do need to have all of our white-collar people combining forces and working together as a team and building these, we've got an overarching model where we've got, it's not actually called the NSN, it's called White Australia. And we have the NSN as our primary activist network. We have the EAM, which is our active club organization, which has been running just as long as NSN. And a lot of people have been confused with that, is, are you NSN or are you EAM? And it's like, well, look, for all public purposes, I guess we're NSN, but we've always had EAM running in the background as more of a community building and active club operation. And obviously what we're transitioning into is, how do we go about building we don't have a name for it. We've got a team of guys at the moment, some within the org itself and some people that we've recruited from outside the org that don't want to necessarily run around the park and do push-ups or run around the street in black block saying Australia for the white man, but they do believe Australia's for the white man. And so we're trying to build a team that, I don't have a name for it just yet, but I'll come up with one eventually when it's necessary. Their main focus is just lawfare. Their main focus is just getting guys getting judgments at higher levels of court so that the political rights of Australians are protected, whether that be to do with freedom of speech, which we actually do have in Australia. We do. And that's what's being contested at the moment, is we've got two different sets of laws in Australia that are contradictory to each other. And we're the guys that are going to be going to the high court saying, well, hang on a minute. You can't exist in a state of, here's four judgments within our constitution saying we have free speech, and here's four new laws that have been passed in the last 12 months that say we don't have freedom of speech. So which one is it? So it needs to be contested. They've overstretched, overreached, and we're going to catch them lacking. I think there's a very strong chance we're going to catch them lacking when it goes before the High Court, and they're shitting themselves at the moment, and they don't know exactly what to do. And the people that are responsible for this fumble and this mistake, they're just going to be removed from office, and a bunch of new faces that haven't made mistakes yet are going to be put in place. And that's a band-aid issue that the system always has. but multifaceted. And again, media is another important wing of any political organization. That's something that the right wing in Germany did very, very well. Right wing, you know, the nationalists in Germany did very well in the late Weimar years, was they had a huge amount of right wing media. Now, in Australia, all we really have, what we have on our side, there's a great independent media company called The Noticer, which does a very objective and fine job at stating the facts. And that is absolutely, you know, I see grandmas and grandpas, I even see leftists sharing articles from The Noticer. And that's a great alternative media platform to what we call Sky News or Sky News. So I'm sure you've got Sky News as well in Britain. It's like in Australia, it's like our equivalent of Fox News. I think three quarters or over three quarters of the presenters are Zionists. The whole platform is a Zionist platform, but I mean, I think three quarters are actually Jewish Zionists and the rest are non-Jewish Zionists. And it's an absolutely horrible and disgusting platform that has maybe 10% at best fair and reasonable people on it. I think 10%, maybe 20% of the guys on that platform actually care about Australia. They just unfortunately have to also care about Israel in order to care about Australia at the same time. But that is a genuinely horrible platform outside of that sort of 10%. And that is a dangerous situation where the right wing is reliant on one singular news platform to try to get any sort of fair take in their favor, because they're always going to attack us because it's a complete Zionist operation to control the right wing. So media would be just as important as your lawfare, as your legal lobby. Whereas what I get asked by a lot of the older guys is, where is the ADL for white people? You know, where's the Anti-Defamation League for white people? Where's the white lobby? And I think that is absolutely, and I know that one of your colleagues, is it Kate? Kate is trying to build a white lobby, I believe, at the moment in England. But I'm sure you guys are doing.
We have, well, we work with a group called the Workers of England Union. So they have actually set up a trade union, and that's who we sort of ally with, because they've actually got qualified legal experts, which is what you need to win these cases. And we partner with them to help promote a genuine trade union that stands up for workers. And obviously, a trade union has to be all encompassing. It can't discriminate on the basis of race. So anyone can join the Workers of England Union. But the Workers of England Union is the only union in the country that will defend nationalists who are sacked for speaking their mind. And this year, we've already had some massive wins doing that. And we work with a solicitor called Robin Tilbrook, who runs a political party called the English Democrats. And he is the only solicitor in the country that has used civil law to actually, because he's a practicing solicitor, you see, so he can go to court to sue the leaders of the grooming gangs to get civil compensation for the victims. Because what happens in this country, which this might shock you, with the grooming gangs, they get very, very short sentences, and they might be forced to pay a couple of £1,000 in compensation. But most of these men are actually quite wealthy. They own their own businesses, they own property, and their wealth is tied up in lots of different assets that can be seized. Well, Robin Tilbrook actually used the civil courts to take a convicted grooming gang leader who had already been found guilty in the criminal courts through the civil court system. And they got a massive compensation package. So what we're actually hoping to do is roll out a system whereby as soon as these grooming gang leaders are released from prison, we immediately take them to court, civil court, and seize their houses. Because in their community, going to jail actually doesn't shame them. Their community stands by them. But when they lose their wealth and their house, that does shame them, and it hits them a lot harder. Because most people can stand 4 or 5 years in jail. Most people can't stand losing a £500,000 house. You know, that affects the entire family. So we do have legal advocacy, and we do it with those groups. Now, there is one question I wanted to ask you briefly, because we're going to the second hour now. I'm going to do the super chats. If you haven't super chatted yet, but you'd like to contribute to my work on the show, please consider doing so. But one thing I was going to ask you is, I don't know if you saw it, but I did a review of the recent documentary on NSN. I did it here on Odyssey. I watched the full thing live and gave commentary on it. And I've got to say, it was one of the most blatant and disingenuous hit pieces I've ever seen. So even in the UK, the hit pieces aren't as bad as that, because the whole thing built up to like some kind of terrorist attack. And then the terrorists ended up being Muslims or blacks, and it was nothing to do with you. They're obviously using that, or try to use that show, to bring in new laws or new legislation to potentially harm you. Is that something you worry about in the future, the media colluding with the state to actually bring in some kind of legislation that would outright stop you advocating in the way that you are?
It's not a new concern of mine, because it's been happening since day one. If you are familiar or remember that I was imprisoned without trial for 7 months before given bail, and having a whole series, I think 12 out of 13 charges were dropped and I was released from prison. That occurred in 2021 during the COVID lockdowns. And when I tried to get full disclosure from the prosecution, which is what it's called here in Australia, I'm sure it's called something similar in Britain, full disclosure, is that correct, Mark? Yeah, so when we try to get full disclosure for the defense,
it's just called disclosure. When they have to give, in the UK, they have to give you every bit of evidence that supports your case as well, even if it undermines their case. And just as a funny aside, when they took me to jail, I made a claim that we'd had information that Muslims had guns in mosques in Bradford. When I got my disclosure bundle, there was actually a redacted piece showing that the police actually did have information that Muslims had guns in mosques in Bradford. So, yeah, we do have disclosure.
Yeah, so when my lawyers organized full disclosure from the police, there was actually a bar on that. There was a ban on that full disclosure, and or a stop, a hold. I don't know what the exact term was called, but they went to a higher court. And they did something called public interest immunity, which basically is like, this is a state secret. It's against the public's interest to know this state secret. And therefore, Mr. Sewell and the defense can't have full disclosure. And we got this very small, very thin, maybe not even one quarter disclosure. I don't even think we got one quarter of what we asked for in the disclosure. And they sent three King's Counsels to the higher court, not the high court, but to the, I think it was the county and they sent three King's Counsels. And can you guess who the three King's Counsels represented? One, the police, the prosecutor; one, the attorney general, which is ASIO, the government; and one, Channel 9, the news. Now, why would Channel 9 be sending a King's Counsel to a serious court of law in Australia to ban Thomas Sewell from getting full disclosure to defend against false allegations if they're not in collusion already? Why would Channel 9, ASIO, and Victoria Police both send one lawyer each, why would three of them come to court together to say to a county court judge, we don't think Thomas Sewell should have the information he needs to defend himself because it's against the public's interest? So it's not a new concern of mine. I've known from day one that a lot of these media companies are embedded with ASIO operatives. And ASIO has admitted that themselves. ASIO just doesn't give a fuck, clearly. And when they've been in Senate inquiries, the head of ASIO, Mike Burgess, which is equivalent to your MI5, has said that we have journalists in our employment. I mean, that's a pretty fucking stupid thing to say, don't you think? And we all know how the American system works, where the majority of journalists are CIA or ex-CIA in America. So likewise, I'm sure Britain and Australia is no different. They're either intelligence operatives, or they are left-wing communists. And it's usually pretty easy to tell which one is which, because one always supports Israel and the other doesn't support Israel. And that's how you can tell which ones are communists and which ones are intelligence operatives. So that's what we deal with globally, in the or especially in the Anglosphere. But I don't think Russia or Ukraine would be any different, or Poland or Hungary. I'm pretty sure they've got the same problem. I'm not concerned about them passing any laws to ban us, because we have survived like three major Senate inquiries. We get raised at the Senate question time all the time. Mike Burgess, the leader, the head of ASIO, has to be rolled out every time questions are asked about us. And he has to sit there and roll his eyes and look at his deputies and say, well, you know, they're awful people, but they're currently not breaking the law, and I'm not making any recommendations to have them listed as a terror group. And he has to unfortunately do that about four times a year for the past sort of, ridiculous number of these inquiries. So even he's getting bored of them. Even I'm getting bored of them. I don't even watch them anymore. I just get the highlight reel now, because they usually go for 3 hours. At least, sometimes more, sometimes 6 hours. I used to watch it start to finish, stressing out. Oh God, are we going to get? You know what I mean? The word you don't want me to say on stream. But are we going to get themed and become political prisoners? And am I doing 10 years in jail and getting some peace and quiet so I can write a book or five? But now I don't really stress about it at all, because we've just. It would take a radical, it would take a few things. It would take a number of things. But that hit piece that they did on us was really just low energy. It was the worst one they've ever done. What was it called again? Leaving Hate.
I think it was just called Radicalized, wasn't it? That was the name.
Okay. Okay. Well, maybe it was called that, but I saw it advertised as Leaving Hate. I'm pretty sure it was the ABC, which is the Australian Broadcasting Company.
Yeah, let me just look it up. It was on my Odyssey. Anyway, what was it actually called? Because let me see if I can find it.
Yeah. It's not super crucial, but
It was called Radicalized. That was the, and I think, yeah, that was, well, that was the name on the graphic that they produced. And then there was, yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So I think that was the lowest effort that they've ever done. They've never made an attack on us so low energy. And obviously it's a very lazy, their strategy was very lazy and improper. And I don't think it really convinced anyone, but the real lowest, the lowest end of the bell curve in terms of political perception, which we're not really going to be gaining their support anytime soon either. But anyone that was perceptive and actually paid attention while watching it, even to the smallest degree, while they're doing their nightly routine of having dinner or whenever it was on television, they would see that, okay, what are they talking about? Okay, a 17 or 18-year-old joined the org. The mother's upset that he joined the org. She freaked out and contacted the media because apparently I'm kidnapping her son by having him come to our boxing training voluntarily, and then try to conflate that with several non-whites that went and committed terror attacks, and one white autistic teenager that was groomed by a mosque into committing a terror attack and then went back to talking about us. So, you know, it's called a shit sandwich, and we were the bread. And, you know, Islamic terror was the shit in the middle, and they were trying to conflate us with them. And I don't think it was effective. I think it was lazy. I was expecting it to be way worse. But maybe our OPSEC's a little bit better now. And we caught a journalist a little bit before that. And he turned out to be a gay meth addict. And he just promoted us. He just wrote articles about how we've got blonde white baby makers. And, you know, we've got a fertility model. And, you know, we're having lots of babies. And we're encouraging women to be, you know, trad. And, you know, and this was written by a guy that's written articles in the past about going over to Thailand and having sex with little boys for $12. I mean, so these are our enemies. I think we're doing pretty well, to be honest. I don't think anyone, they're just so out of touch. I mean, how can a gay meth addict criticize? In what world does a gay meth addict have any right to criticize a bunch of wholesome, normal, chungus white people that are, you know, having babies, having families, and, you know, dancing around a maypole. I mean, they just put all of our Wholesome Chunga's best optics up and then put dark, gloomy music on. And they interviewed, I think, two gay brothers from one of the wives. I think one of the wives in the org has
yeah, those two freaks were absolutely reprehensible. I mean, and, they were talking about, like, you know, the way to bring up children. I was like, I actually said there's no way I'd let them anywhere near my children.
Yeah, and this just shows the complete out of touchness of the regime. And as I've always said, Mark, it's about heightening the contradictions. And sometimes these people do our job for us, because it's actually our job to heighten the contradictions, not theirs. It's their job to muddy the waters. But they made it really clear that we're nice, wholesome white people having blonde babies. And the people that don't like that are pink-haired freaks with shit in their face that suck dick every second night on Grindr. So it's not looking good for them. They're not sending their best. They're not really thinking this through. You know, these aren't your grandfather's Jews, is the expression that I heard from one of the senior members. These aren't your grandfather's Jews. These are privileged, very, very privileged, lazy Jews and non-whites. This is DEI hit pieces. I mean, this is the DEI. It was like a Sri Lankan chick that was obviously organizing it. We're currently in communication with a Channel 7 journalist. Channel 7 is not a very good, reputable company either. It is better than the ABC, and it's definitely better than Channel 9. Now, this guy, again, I'm no spring chicken to this. You know, I'm sure a lot of people will be like, Thomas, be careful. Thomas, you have to be really careful. Thomas, I don't know if you know this, but journalists are sneaky. Thomas, be careful. I mean, so just everyone in the comments section that's about to say this, just hold your tongue, all right? This is not my first rodeo, okay? I've done this a few times now. I'm actually kind of sharp, and I know how to wield the sword of truth. So just don't stress so much. You know, the hysteria that's going to come from this line. But there's a journalist at the moment that wants to do an insider documentary on us. He wants to do it properly, unlike what these people have done, where they've kind of done a hit piece without our permission and not even give us, you know, 15 seconds to defend ourselves. And now, will he succeed in his operation in terms of passing through the editor stage? Probably not. And if it does, it'll be edited to hell, of course. But we're going to show them what we do as an organization. We're going to give this guy an insight into, you know, the plan, not necessarily the planning, but we'll probably LARP some planning. We don't want to give away what we're doing before we're doing it, but we'll let him film our activism. We'll let him film some of the training that we do. And, you know, he asked if he can film like some political meetings. And so, you know, we're working out a way of doing that without having guys doxed, and just giving them a little bit of an open insight thing. We are building our own documentary as well at the moment. It's a very important thing to show the public and show people what you're actually doing with your organization, so that they have an insider take, so that it's not all just doom and gloom music on the ABC. But yeah, we're working on those two projects at the moment with this Channel 7 journalist, and obviously with our own internal one, which we need a lot of work and a lot of practice to pump that out. And yeah, I think that one, I'm actually quite excited for my next meeting with this Channel 7 guy, because he kind of got a bit famous during the COVID situation for being one of the only journalists that was actually against the lockdowns and against the COVID issues. And he actually lost his job at Channel 7 because of that. And he's since been rehired and will be, you know, I think he'll give us the fairest go we could possibly get. And, you know, we'll put on a little spectacle and show people what we are. But obviously, long term, it's not the solution. Long term, we need to produce all of our own media ourselves. But it would be an interesting way of working with I mean, they're going to do a hit piece on us anyway. So I've got nothing to hide. Truth fears no investigation. So it would be better to sit down and have the interviews with them. The most likely scenario is, I don't know if you remember when I did the interview with Todd Sampson from Channel 10. Todd Sampson, he's quite a famous, I think he's Canadian, but he's quite famous in Canada and in Australia. He's kind of like a Louis Theroux. He's like a 40 cent Louis Theroux. He's not as famous as Louis Theroux. You've been interviewed by Louis Theroux, haven't you?
No.
Oh, you
haven't? Wanted to do, he reached out to my organization at one point, sort of wanting to do like a weird weekend, but we said sort of no. Yeah. Like he comes along and he sort of, we have to do the super chats in a minute, but he comes along and does the whole, like, you know, well, we're going to make you look like you're a, you know, he comes along and sort of makes friends with you, but then makes you out that you're the weirdest people that he spent time with. And he's done it with right-wingers before. He's done it with some American groups. And I'm kind of skeptical about doing things like that. We tend to shy away from the fly-on-the-wall documentaries, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah. Well, different horses for different courses. I think we did really well. We got a lot of really good feedback, Blair and I, from the public for our interview with Sam Newman, who is a huge talking head here in Australia. Like, he is probably one of the most influential talking heads before he got kicked off the mainstream news for being, you know, too anti-woke, so to speak. And he is one of the biggest, he was one of the biggest and most influential characters in Australian media. And we went on his podcast, and obviously you would have seen that. And for some reason, he had a hard-on for Blair in a bad way. Apparently I was the most reasonable person he's ever met from this side of politics, which I thought was kind of bizarre because I'm pretty extreme. Blair was kind of the moderating factor, and for some reason, Sam saw it the other way around. But either way, you know, I think that was really effective because it was a sit down for 40 minutes or 50 minutes and ideas could be properly fleshed out. And a lot of older people that have you know, watched Sam Newman for 20, 30 years were saying to me that they've never actually, because they don't watch these kind of shows. They don't watch a Mark Collette, Tom Sewell podcast. They don't watch a Joel Davis, Blair Cottrell podcast, but they will watch Sam Newman. They'll sit down for 40 minutes and watch Sam Newman waffle on about something. And so they'd actually only ever seen the media's perception of us in those little 15-second segments on the news. They've never actually seen us be sit down before and interviewed for any extended period of time. And they were quite surprised. And these are people that aren't supporters of the org. They were very surprised at how much they agreed with basically everything that we had to say, except maybe they're not as historically literate like Sam isn't on Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust, which we don't need to get into. And likewise, I think with this Channel 7 interview, we will get a chance to show people what we actually are, what we actually do, and that we're a completely voluntary organization and try to fight back against this nonsense that giving young white men a system of values and giving young white men a new way of behaving that they haven't been exposed to before within the faggot education system, and that there are actually positive male role models in society, you'll just find that they're all on the right or they're all in the pro-white scene because they're the only people that actually care about a future for our people. And to do that, we need to rebuild man and woman as the building block of society. And man and woman is fundamentally sick within liberal democracy. And our political views, the root of them is to rebuild man as a new archetype and to rebuild woman as a new archetype. And we have had a lot of people reach out to us, not just in the media, but within people that have left mainstream political parties. And the thing that they're most amazed and sort of surprised about us as a political identity is our obsession, as they call it, with physical fitness. They find that fact, they actually like it. It's shocking to them, but they're amazed by it in the sense that they've never seen so many people come together with a political idea, but engage in physical activity. And they said to us, I've had one guy recently who was someone, I won't say who and where, but someone deep within the system that's leaving the system and sort of seeking out to help people like us, not necessarily overthrow the system, but certainly surpass it. And he was saying that the reason why the Liberal Party is so afraid of you guys is because you guys can get more people to a boxing session with a political identity attached to it than they can to a political meeting. And that scares the hell out of them because they can't even get people to sit in a seat and listen. And you guys are getting them to run 10 kilometers. That's impressive. And that's why they're freaking out and they don't know how to treat you guys. They don't know how to deal with you guys because of the sheer tenacity and mental fortitude and strength that you guys have. Just the vitality of the whole culture, the political culture we're building. So we are building a new archetype of man and a new archetype of women. Most of our women, not all, but most of our women have little side hobbies that they help out the movement with. They're not just, you know, all just, you know, barefoot, you know, pregnant and in the kitchen, although a whole bunch of them are a lot of the time of the year. But they also have hobbies. They make trinkets. They do little art projects. They do things that they want to do. They're not, a lot of them aren't going to work. There's very few women in our community that go to work, but it's not frowned upon. They can, of course, if they want to learn skills and do certain things. But you know, everyone knows what the priority is, and it's focusing, if you can afford it, on having, which I think everyone can. It's just about taking a hit to the standard of living without a dual income. I think everyone can do it. It's just what you prioritize, a certain standard of living or six children. Me, it's obvious. And I think with a lot of women in our scene, it's obvious. But yeah, they're shocked at that, because the Liberal Party and the Labour Party, they're trying to turn women into prime ministers. And they've got all these staffers, and they've got this culture within parliament where they're hiring fucking gay prostitutes and, you know, raping each other in parliament. And then they're complaining on the Australian Broadcasting Company that we've got women dancing around the maypole holding babies and pregnant. And it's like, wow, that's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it? The evil outsiders are having little nice community festivals on Midsummer. Which was, you know, near Christmas, 3 days before Christmas, you know, doing these cute little kind of European, Aryan, Anglo-centric community days, while Parliament, they're having fucking gay orgies. It's a little bit different, isn't it? So who will triumph in the end? Who will triumph? Yeah, the righteous or the evil? Yeah, let's do
some of these super chats, and then we'll see who triumphs. It's okay to be a nationalist, gave 1488. Thank you so much. So Thomas, are there billions of Indians attending their weird water purifying ceremony in heaven? I don't know what that means, but maybe.
Short context, I said on stream that one way of looking at politics is not as a political identity, but as a near religious identity. And that whether you're Christian or whether you're pagan or whether you're agnostic, the idea of heaven is something that you can fathom. The idea of a future, some point in the eternal and the ethereal, where you go after your life, or where your children go after your life, that's something that I think most people can imagine and can have a creative concept of. And a political idea is quite simple, but it can be subject to change. Whereas an idea of heaven is quite eternal; it's not really subject to change. And so the conversation was not, are there going to be millions of Indians in Australia, but are there going to be millions of Indians in heaven? And the water purification ceremony is some Hindu ritual where I think 450 million Hindus came to this one river and just sludged the whole river out. And there was a video of it that went viral on Twitter of the world's biggest religious meeting. And what I asked was, is this in heaven? Do you see this in heaven? Like, in your vision of heaven, does this concept exist? And the answer is, of course, no. And I preface that with, are there birds in heaven? Are there bees in heaven? Of course. Are there 450 million Indians doing a water purification ceremony in your version of heaven? That's the question people should ask themselves. And then that can help them perhaps
probably
not. Yeah. So that then, are there grooming gangs in heaven? No. So why are there grooming gangs here? Well, clearly we're not in heaven yet. So we should be working towards that, shouldn't we? We should be working towards a better afterlife for ourselves and our children. And so we got to solve these problems in a number of ways, including the political.
Indeed. Adair Churuska gave $5. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, good episode and powerful takes. Thank you very much. Stan Wong gave $25. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, great show, great guest. Here in Britain, we recently had a former government advisor stating that a future civil war is a real possibility. Is that the same possibility for Australia? And will the dystopia of Mad Max become a real scenario?
I wouldn't go as far as Mad Max, but it's certainly a prophetic idea with the fuel shortages that we're going to have incorporated with the space and distance between living communities in Australia. But yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, Mark's already concerned where I'm going with this question, so I'll behave. But yeah, obviously it's not our fault. Obviously it's not white nationalism that's going to cause a civil war. It's liberal democracy. Liberal democracy is continuing to lump non-integratable people that hate each other just as much as they hate us in a lot of cases. Liberal democracy is lumping all of these people together, And it's a recipe for disaster. And our goal is to actually prevent that disaster. There's obviously a lot of people that are preparing for it, but we need to prevent it. There needs to be a concerted effort, a strong effort to prevent that from happening. And the only rational way to prevent civil war is mass deportations. Because otherwise, I mean, look at the Middle East. Look at what happens when you lump a whole bunch of different ethnicities. They're actually pretty similar to each other in one space. It's sectarian violence is the result of all these vastly different communities on a long enough timeline, because that's the, yeah, that I'll leave it there, Mark. How does that sound? I don't want to get too deep on that question, do I?
I want to say this. I'm just going to say this. This was actually on a podcast. There's this woman, and I've just looked it up so I get the name right. She's a British journalist called Louise Perry. And she does this podcast called Maiden Mother Matriarch. And she's got less than 30,000 subscribers on YouTube, so significantly less popular than I was when I was on there. And this podcast she's done has blown up. And the podcast is called The Coming Civil War. Now, I find this really interesting because I'm looking up this Louise Perry. And I think, you know, she's obviously somebody who's got some sort of influence in the system. And I kind of get really suspicious when you have a woman like that, some female journalist, she's allowed on YouTube and she starts talking about civil war, about the breakdown of society, how this is all going to be on racial lines. Now, I know that if I did a podcast saying, look, society is going to break down, there's going to be a civil war on racial lines and this is the end, I'd get my door kicked through within a couple of days. And I kind of look at people doing things like that. And then I see people who were arrested after the Southport incident who've said far less than that, who just said, look, you know, problems are coming to a town near you. And they ended up, you know, serving 2-3 weeks in jail for just saying problems coming to a town near you. And then there's this journalist with, you know, some government advisor like doing Fed Post Central. And I kind of wonder what their game is, you know, because I always, after being around as long as I have, I always smell a rat when people who are so involved in the system come out and are allowed to do a YouTube video that by any other standard would be an instant ban and a knock on the door. So probably beware of that weird Louise Perry. That's my advice. Great Works gave $100. Thank you so much for your generosity. He said, thank you, Mark, for networking between nationalists and the Commonwealth. I think the UK may fall, but we'll still all in this together. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, UK, Ireland and the US to a lesser extent. In my opinion, the US is so opposed to us ideologically, it will always oppose Commonwealth unity. Look, I love people from Australia, New Zealand. I like people from the US. I think the thing is, one thing I've always tried to foster throughout my sort of, you know, 300 episodes of PWR and 100 episodes of This Week on the Alt-Right is getting people from all over the white world to work together. Because This nonsense that because there's been ethnic rivalries in the past, there should be ethnic rivalries now is just divisive, because every single group of white people, wherever they are in the world, whether they're indigenous or whether they're settlers who build a proud nation, we all face the same problem. So if we don't stand together, we'll all be screwed separately. That's how I see it.
Absolutely.
Anyway. Ben gave $3, thank you so much, and said, hello, Thomas. To touch on what you said on the issue of left versus right, do you think that the association of far-right politics with anti-female sentiment is harmful to white nationalism in terms of attracting young white women to the movement? Anti-whites seem to have got a grip on that demographic.
I would argue that politics is polarizing everywhere, that it's polarizing for young men, it's polarizing for young women. And so we are living in a society where toxic femininity is never called out. Not once. No one is doing it. No one is doing it that's a reasonable person. The only people that are doing it are these kind of online mulatto pimps. And that's not good that they can control that sentiment. So because it is a genuine sentiment, there is a genuinely toxic behavior in both young men and young women. Now, all the potentially toxic behavior in young men that's being called out usually isn't actually toxic behavior. It's traditional behavior. Traditional notions of masculinity are the healthy and normal ones. and they've been conflated as being toxic. Obviously, there are some improper and impious behaviors that are maybe not so much traditional, but maybe archaic, that are called out from time to time. And I don't usually engage too much in that, in calling that stuff out. But what I have done in the past is I've been honest enough, one out of every 365 takes is to call out certain types of female behavior. And what I've noticed is that that is a fixation point for some people to argue that the entire right wing or far right or white nationalist scene is now going to fail because now we've alienated women as a whole because one or two or three behaviors have potentially been called out. And second to that, the idea that I'm not a human being and I'm not allowed personal preferences, that I'm your spokesperson, I'm your slave, and I'm beholden to only hold opinions that you agree with. And that I can't have my personal tastes in this world. I can't be an individual. I'm not entitled to any sort of individuality, which makes me a character, that makes me a more than just a political spokesperson. I find personally reprehensible because no one's holding anyone else to that account. So that's my statement about that. I don't think that we're losing the female population. I think that liberal democracy is losing the female population. And I think liberal democracy is destroying the white female population. And we shouldn't be looking at gender or class war. I am a National Socialist and I believe in what Adolf Hitler believes, which is that we need class marriage and that we need marriage between men and women, that we need a marriage of the sexes where men and women are working together for a collective future. Now, part of working together is having those difficult and uncomfortable conversations with each other. Women have absolutely no shortage of complaints about male behavior. They've got an infinite list. But every now and then, men have some small concerns with female behavior where there needs to be a course correction. And I think we attract a lot of women to the scene that in the past we hadn't, in terms of this was a very almost entirely male-dominated space. I go on Twitter now and I see just as many women using our talking points, even anti-feminist talking points, as there are men. And I don't think that these are just groupies and girls that are jumping on the bandwagon because it's a celebrity scene. I think that the average girl that is polarized into our politics is aware that there's too much toxic female behavior, and it's part of the reason and part of taking responsibility. So men and women both need to share that responsibility. Obviously, more is always going to be expected of the men. And for the hypothetical, let's say, so it should be that way. But I do notice that certain people call them wife guys. I obviously have used a different term in the past, which has caused controversy because it shouldn't be a controversial term. But I do warn all the time against a culture of submissive men. I do warn all the time against a culture where men politically aren't trusting their instincts and instead are resting their judgment on the feelings and opinions of their partners, of their women, or of just random women on the internet, which is even worse. And we do have to work together. We do have to lean on each other's instincts to an extent. But men need to assert their instincts. So I can go into more depth if they want, but I think that covers the question quite coherently.
It certainly does. It was made up, gave $10. Thank you so much. Said your banners are awesome. Destroy Pedo Freaks is possibly the greatest banner of all time. Thank you so much. I agree. It's a good banner. Jagdeep Jaino.
I'll quickly respond to that. I think the secret to banners is somewhere between 2 to 4 words. I think between 2 to 4 words, and it has to be as aggressive as possible within the law. I think a successful banner is right up into that point where that line is, and it really hits hard. It's a force multiplier. I think that if you have a kind of, obviously different horses for different courses, but I think the success of that banner came from the fact that it was just 3 words. It was just sharp. It was revolutionary. And it there's no compromise in the message. It was just pure. It was beautiful. It was keener.
Thank you. Jagdeep Jenniger, $15. Thank you so much. Hey, both. Question for you, Tom. You spoke about how Keith Woods recently had his cringeworthy private messages leaked by a former adult worker who is now a groiper named Slater. Could you give your take on this and psychoanalyze Keith? Why was he attracted to her? Are men really that desperate? Well, I'm going to Google this Slater to see whether she is attractive enough for a DM.
I'm not sure if you'll find anything on Google. I think the account was called Slater House on Twitter. It's probably still on Twitter. And I had people reach out and say this is a Fed operation. I don't think so. I think it's just a mentally ill former prostitute or prostitute.
Very strange looking, isn't she?
Yeah, definitely some sort of blood dilution in there. But yeah, I did make a comment and I didn't attack Keith. I didn't feel the need to dogpile.
Too many tattoos. She's literally covered. She's got more tattoos than my ex. She's literally covered in tattoos. Like there isn't like a spare bit of skin, is there?
Yeah, which is not a good look. Not a very good look.
She's got a Breaking Bad tattoo on her leg.
Yes. Yes. That also made the meme rounds. Look, at the end
really
of the day.
She likes Nick Fuentes, though.
Yeah, well, she fits in with that crowd, doesn't she?
Do you know what's odd about her? Like, I mean, if he'd had, like, maybe quite a lot of alcohol and she sort of came up to you when you were, you know, pretty inebriated, I'm sure that you could be persuaded. But, the issue is this. I never thought that would be Keith's type. Keith is such a sort of an intelligent, erudite, charming young man. I didn't think that would be Keith's sort of thing. Keith, who are you? Do we even know the real Keith?
I would have expected like a shorter kind of goth girl, maybe. If I was running a government honeypot operation, I would have lined up all the goth e-girls and I would have been like, we've got a mission. We're going after the Keith. And I would have picked out, you know, the archetype of a certain type of goth girl. But yeah, I think like what I said on stream in brief was that he didn't really do anything wrong. He didn't really do anything that bad. Like obviously there's a little bit of cringe there, but look, if that's the worst that they could get, it's not really that bad. She's obviously look at it, it's a problem. But what I said on stream was that she presented as a snake, and yeah, she presented as a snake. That's a snake. And when you have a snake telling you that this is me, I am a snake, look at me, you know, and you confide in them, because she messaged probably two dozen public faces. She messaged me asking me for advice on how to find a man, and I told her to stop being a slut. She messaged Jacob, same shit. She messaged Keith. She probably messaged, I mean, a whole range of people. I think she messaged Joel. Joel blocked her straight away because we told him, like, this bitch is crazy. And, you know, we started just blocking her. You know, obviously, as a public figure, you get DMs all the time. You get e-girls and DMs all the time. And most of them you just block, and some of them are just amicable and you can just answer their question. And they might not ever message you again, or they might try to help you in some way. They might have some sort of, you know, they might give some sort of advice, or not necessarily advice, it's probably not the best way to put it. But in this case, obviously, you have someone that's very clearly mentally ill. And, you know, it's just sad that out of all the people that she messaged, the one person that was actually nice to her, and this is my take, this is what I said on stream, the one person that was nice to her, she betrayed. You know?
Yeah, no, do you know what?
It's just fucking evil. Like, it's just a fundamentally evil creature. Like, Keith didn't do anything.
Keith's he's a single, really nice guy.
Yeah, he's a single man. He's entertained by a woman that is really just an adult entertainer. And, You know, he didn't do anything silly. He didn't send any nudes to her. Like, there's way worse scandals than what Keith's done. And yeah, obviously they just dogpiled him because they used that as an opportunity to attack the personal, when obviously Joel did a really good job at attacking the political. You know, him and Joel had a great discourse recently about nationalism versus National Socialism. And the e-girl shit is just a side quest drama that takes away from the political mission. And Keith's done a very good job at handling it and just putting his head down and just focusing on the mission. And that's what all of us should do, regardless of distractions.
Yeah, look, I gotta say this. Keith's a really
should
nice
be used
guy.
As motivation
to
for
be
everyone.
Honest. To be honest, like, you know, Keith's far too good for her. So look, Keith, if you need some brotherly advice, come to Big Mark. I'll help you out. Number one bit of advice: don't go for a girl like that. I'll give you the rest off stream. Yeah. The resident baker gave 1488. Thank you so much. Said, great show, Mark. Very pleased to finally see you and Tom in the discussion. Does Tom have an update on Stephen Wells? Also, congratulations to Tom on the recent birth of his second child.
Thank you for that. The update on Stephen Wells is he's still fighting the principal. He's an absolute legend. He's a martyr for the cause. No one's putting it up. Him up for it. He's just doing it himself. He wants to argue the principle that he shouldn't be punished with bail conditions for wearing a hat and sunglasses in public. That's absolutely an injustice, and he's going all the way with it and wants to prove a point. I do have some messages that I haven't responded to that have come into my inbox over the last 24 hours or 48 hours regarding an update on him. But yeah, we're just trying to get a bail amendment so that he can be not in prison and also not punished outside of prison for wearing a hat and sunglasses. About a third of the charges for the, I think there was about 34 court cases over the fortnight. I think 16 non-Victorians that, sorry, non-South Australians that had gone to South Australia. And I think almost 18, I think 18 South Australians were charged prior to. So the media made a big argument saying that, oh, no South Australians were charged. There was all just these outsiders. But that's because they charged 18 guys the week before the rally to have them on bail conditions to stop them from going to the rally. So they actually charged more South Australians than they did. And there was one random member of the public from South Australia that that was charged as well. So I think there was 19 South Australians and 15 from outside of South Australia. And yeah, about a third of those charges have already been dropped, and it seems to be at random. There seems to be no system to why some people have had loitering dropped and some people are still fighting loitering, and some people have had article of disguise dropped and others are still fighting article of disguise. And the symbols charge is going to have to be fought in the High Court because we have the right to political communication, gestures, symbols, signs. So this is a High Court thing. This is a constitutional matter. Can't be fought at magistrates. And so if we don't get a bail amendment for Stephen Wells, he's going to be in there for a very long time, which I'm not 100% sure how he's going. I do know that he has had some phone calls with the guys, but he's getting tortured like we all were in solitary confinement. He's getting tortured. So nothing new under the sun in that regard. He's in solitary confinement being tortured. And that's what they do to political prisoners here in Australia. That's what they did to the 16 of us for 3 days, locked in cells with the light on for 3 days straight and fed two sausage rolls a day and a glass of water. So, and I actually had the privilege this time of having a Jeremy Clarkson book, which was pretty funny, a Top Gear book, which was just a series of articles where he's calling people Trotskyites and communists and mentioning Hitler every third article, which I thought was pretty funny. But yeah, that book was actually pretty horrible. So I almost would have preferred a religious book. But it's this is what they do. This is what they do. This is the system. This is what you have to consider when you go down this path. But it only makes you stronger. And Stephen Wells is a very intelligent man, and he's a very strong-spirited man. And he's going to take a while to recover from what he's going through. I know for me personally, spending that much time in solitary confinement, it takes you a long time to get your head. You have to spend a lot of time in nature and staring at trees for, you know, extended periods of time because you haven't seen anything alive for so long. It's a fascinating experience to see something living and just work out a way of moving on with your life and getting back into being politically effective. And he's a very strong-willed man. So they've just radicalized the entire public against the system for locking up a man on Australia Day, for celebrating Australia Day. I mean, and he kind of just looked at me, and it was like something out of Batman. What is it? The Dark Knight Rises. And he kind of just looked at me, and I just had this psychic feeling. And he was just saying, they expect one of us in the wreckage, brother. And that's kind of, yeah, he's tough as nails. So it does feel a bit sad. But look, there is no victory without sacrifice. And he understands that. We all understand that in our organization. Sometimes the sacrifice is very small. Sometimes the sacrifice is very great. And we need to remember that there are men in other countries that have died. There's many men that have died for things even less important than this, and many men that have died for how important this is. So it is horrible. Anyone that has experience in solitary confinement will know that it is torture. It is a method of torture. So our strength goes out to him. He needs it.
Well, thank you so much. Thin Red Line gave $14. Thanks so much. I came very late and we'll have to watch the replay. Thank you so much. Der Trusky gave another $5. Thank you very much. Think 1,000 times before taking a decision, but after taking a decision, never turn back. Even if you get 1,000 difficulties, keep on fighting, comrades. Thank you very much. 1488 came from Pure Nomad. Thank you so much. He said, so happy this PWR with Sewell finally happened. Been busy at work, so we'll catch up on it tomorrow. Thank you very much. Stas Nikiforov gave $6. Thank you very much. He said, hi, Mark and Thomas. Over the years, you both become very dedicated, fierce advocates of white well-being communities in both the UK and Australia. In your own words, what does it mean to protect the biospirit of the West? Also, please stop hating Jews and focus on yourself. Thank you so much, heroes. Prometheus Rising. You don't have to answer that. That was obviously a troll comment to try and get some heat between me and Jason. No white guilt, which we're not going to go down that road. Wizard gave $15. Thank you so much. Said love to the Aussies leading the way. Thank you so much. Poit gave $25. Thank you very much. And said donation. Aunt Sally gave $5. Thank you so much, my dear. She said, thank you, Mark and Thomas. Blade Man gave $3. Thank you very much. Said, hail, Mark. Hail, Tom. Jay Bradley gave $10. Thank you so much. Said, hey, Mark and Tom. Just want to say full respect to Tom and Joel and the boys there. Method is the only way to go. Patriot Front are on the right track too. Nick Fuentes is in bed with the Jews. Hail. I'm not sure Nick Fuentes is in bed with the Jews though. I think that's you can, there's a lot of things that can be a lot of things you can say about Nick, but I don't think he's in bed with the Jews. I think that would be a mischaracterization of his position. No, unless it's not, and I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe I am wrong, but I don't think
he's moving on.
Yeah, VM gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, great stream, both. Mark, on your stream on Farage, it's worth noting his repeatedly strategy of bailing ship the moment people are supposedly led to victory. For example, immediately after the Brexit vote, he had the power to action it from Brussels. No, he didn't. He didn't have the power to action Brexit from Brussels. The person who had the power to action Brexit immediately was David Cameron. David Cameron could have triggered, I think it was called something like Article 5, which would have allowed Britain to leave, and he actually resigned as Prime Minister rather than triggering the exit thing. The only man in Britain that can trigger the exit clause was actually the Prime Minister. That was definitely not Farage's fault in any way, and Farage remained on as an MEP in Brussels until the very last day that Britain had MEPs. MLG gave $15. Thank you so much. Said, phenomenal guest. The Aussie method is the way to go. Well, thank you very much. David gave $25. Thank you so much. Said, Tom, what are your views, if you have any, on Senator Gerald Rennick? He seems to be ruffling a lot of feathers in Parliament.
Yeah, it's so that I don't bore your audience, because you probably don't know who that is in Britain. He's a Liberal, ex-Liberal Party guy. He was elected as a Liberal, so the centre-right, and he got kicked out of the party for being too right-wing. And he's not, I wouldn't consider him right-wing. I would consider him just a centrist. I've never heard him say anything right-wing by our standards. But of course, the standard of right-wing is so low that basically just investigating corruption of the left makes you right-wing. So I have been keeping my eye on him. I have been watching the things he's been doing, and he seems like possibly the most honest and respectable statesman that's in the Australian Parliament. I have nothing but good things to say about him. I don't really know what he thinks of Israel and Zionism and the Jews, to be honest. But I have seen him come out quite clearly saying that the Jewish community, pushed these hate speech laws, and that the government pushed these hate speech laws, full knowing that the caravan attack was a hoax. So he's actually started to dabble in a little bit of common sense anti-Semitism, which for someone in parliament is a very scary thing to do from the right. So I think that he is possibly one of the only honest statesmen that Australia has, and that there is still an old white guard. I am not giving up on Australia as a whole. We've had some great judges. We've had some great judgments in the courts. I mean, when I went to the county court for the entrapment operation, the judge wished Jacob and myself luck with our future. And the left were seething about that. And she gave us a very, very fair judgment. And she did actually really look after us in terms of making sure that we wouldn't lose at the Supreme Court. She spent a month writing out, I don't know how many pages it was. And then when we went to the Supreme Court, we got a good judgment at the Supreme Court, which was a great victory for justice for white Australians. I was honestly shocked. I was not blackpilled, but I was obviously pessimistic as to how the Australian institutions would go dealing with me. I thought I was going to be thrown away for 15 years. And I was quite amazed at how much of an old guard there is still in Australia that knows that the country is being run by pedophiles. And they know which judges and politicians and media people are pedophiles and are getting away with it. They know this. And so when they see young guys like Jacob and I going through the courts, they seem to step on a lot of toes to not be too cruel to us, which is really all the friends you can kind of ask for at this stage of the game. We still got punished, but it was nominal. I got sentenced to 1 month in jail for something I didn't do, but I'd already suffered 7 months in jail. So I didn't get any extra jail, and I've got 6 months in the bank. So, I think that Rennick is an example of the old guard. He's part of the old white men and women that are entrenched in the system, that have done that strategy, that have tried to play the game by the rules, and they actually care about Australia. I think he actually genuinely cares about Australia, which makes him an absolute anomaly in the Australian Parliament. And certainly if I was not doing what I'm doing, I would be fledging my full support towards him. But that's probably not beneficial to him in the way that I think NJP endorsed Trump or David Duke or whatever. You know, I'm not doing that in an official stance, but I see only good and honest and honorable things coming from that man. I'm very impressed by one of the last statesmen I think Australia will ever have.
Well, thank you. VM gave $3. Thank you so much. On electioneering, building power and political system without already having community networks and foolproof infrastructure is like building your sandcastle next to the tide. Permanence is key. Thank you so much. Stuart gave $15. Thank you very much. So thank you, Mark. The guest I've been waiting for. Seeing you two together is great. Question for Tom. Do you think Sam will have you on again? You did really well there.
Sam Newman? Possibly. Yeah, he actually called me afterwards and told me that that all these Jews were calling him, and that it was so frustrating that what they're saying about him isn't true. And I know the truth, that he was just giving me a fair go, and that he wasn't saying he agreed with my views, and why are these Jews attacking me, and they're coming after my Hall of Fame. And, you know, he was being my buddy for a couple hours afterwards. So I thought that was interesting. I didn't expect that. Maybe he'll have me on again in a year or so when he feels the need to stir the pot again. And maybe it'll be best that I go on by myself so that he doesn't have anyone else to flagellate. He has to attack me man on man. He has to play the man. You know what I mean? Like he's a footy boy, so he'd understand that. You know, there was no need to go after Blair. But Blair and Sam Newman were both ruckmen. Blair not at the same level. Blair never played in the AFL, but Blair comes from an AFL family. I technically come from an AFL family as well, somewhat, as my second cousin was the big player at one of the big clubs as well. And his first cousin is currently playing at one of the big clubs. So we are connected to the AFL scene. It is a small world. And that obviously didn't get mentioned. You wouldn't want to humanize us too much. But yeah, it was interesting, his attitude. They're both ruckmen. They're both big boys, as everyone knows that's met Blair in person. And Sam Newman's is a huge guy as well for his age. I mean, he's 80. A lot of people are saying he's schizophrenic. He's not schizophrenic. He's just senile. He's just he's 80. I mean, to be that sharp at 80 is really impressive. He's a thoroughbred, an absolute thoroughbred. So obviously it's not nice the things he said about Blair, and Blair handled himself very well in his responses. But yeah, I would happily go back on Sam Newman's podcast and whisper to the boomers a little bit more truth.
Thank you. Four Camarade gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, true blue, Ridgy, Didge, Dinky D, She'll Be Right, coming up, Apples, Chopper and Jake the Mus. Always looking for new New Zealand and Australia movies. I hear Wolf Creek 3 is finally in production, Tom. The first two movies were top draw. Any new productions to look out for?
Not a new production, but the best Australian movie I've seen in the last couple of years is a movie called Long Tan, which is a movie with the guy that plays, the lead actor is the guy that plays Ragnar in Vikings. And he plays the Australian, I think, captain or lieutenant that's fighting in the Battle of Long Tan in the Vietnam War. And that's a historical battle, 6th Battalion. I learned all this when I joined the Army. And I knew it obviously before, but I really studied it in depth. And it's just a story of true Australian grit, outnumbered, surrounded, and you fight through and you take casualties, but you still win. And that's the Australian spirit from, you know, Kokoda, you know, to Long Tan. It's a story of grit and endurance and Australians constantly punching above their weight. So great movie. I'm a very big movie critic. I know you are as well, Mark. But it's hard to impress me, I'll be honest.
You come and do a movie review with
100%,
us?
100%.
Have you ever seen, there's two really great Australian films that people don't talk about enough. Don't know if you've seen them, but one's called Snowtown, which is one of the most depressing films I've ever seen. It's about the John Bunting, Bodies in Barrels film. And there was a psychological horror film called The Babadook about...
I have watched that. I didn't like that, yeah.
I thought that was really good. And I like the little kid, though. He's just so annoying. He's the most annoying child.
I don't like horror films, and not because I don't like being scared. I like being scared. It's thrilling. But the reason why I have a particular taste with horror films is that I don't like characters that I can't view myself as. And when I'm watching a movie, I like to feel a sense of closeness to at least someone within the film. But horror movies are full of idiots that constantly do the wrong things. And I can't empathize with that. And I have to turn it off because that is actually more painful than the horror. That is for me, the horror is the stupidity of the person making all the mistakes and not dealing with the problem. That traumatizes me deep in my soul. It hurts. I'm angry and I turn off the movie. I'm not scared. I'm just angry, which kind of is a bit of a metaphor for my life politically. I'm not scared of the system. I hate them. I want justice for our people, but I'll leave that rant for another day.
I will say this though: in the Babadook, there's obviously the story.
He's still trying to sell the Babadook to me.
No.
Let me hear it.
There's a pop-up book for kids, which obviously scares the little boy because the Babadook is for. He's like, can you read me a book before bed? I want this book, and it's got like the scary man in it. And at first, he thinks it's fun, but it's actually what sort of brings the monster into the house. But somebody actually made that book. It became so popular and they go for like $1,500 sort of Australian dollars on eBay because they're really rare. So that book actually does have memorabilia out there that it's really sought after. But I wouldn't suggest reading the Babadook book to your child, even if you could afford it. Quite emotionally scarring. Bluey Waffen, which is the best name ever. Do you kids like Bluey?
No, I haven't shown them television yet.
If there's one show that is definitely approved, it's Bluey. It's a really good show and it's quite wholesome. That's a marquee recommendation. Bluey Waffen gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, why do whites tend to favor individualism over group identity? Is it a genetic trait of the white man or is it learned behavior? Congrats on the baby, Mark. Tom looks infinitely more Australian with a mustache. I think whites are individualistic because it wasn't always that way. If you look at Britain in the 1970s, there was still absolutely huge white communities like the mining communities that stood up to the Thatcher government, stood up against the police, literally fought pitched battles with the police over the winter of discontent in 1979. Western individualism came about post the 1980s materialistic lifestyle boom, really. You can actually before that, you see amazing white communities all over the UK. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but individualism really became a thing in the UK from the 80s onwards.
I'm struggling to find a short answer because I know we're close to the end of the show and we've got to get through everything. I have a very long answer, which I have to do on my own stream. But the short version of it is that we've always been both. Why are whites perceived as more individualistic? Well, we currently, I mean, this is going to upset some people. It's because we don't have a strong religion. We need to have a strong religion. It's really a spiritual sense that's going to create strength in us. We're always going to be individuals if we're not, if the building block is not correct. And the building block, in my opinion, of religion is small community, and those small communities uniting with other small communities on the basis of a shared religious, political, cultural, and sense of manners. So we are naturally, I think, slightly more individualistic than the other races, but that is actually our strength. But where we need to come together and form collectives, we're not doing it correctly. The building block is the family. From the family, you have the extended family. From the extended family, you have your friends and their families. And I've been writing about this stuff recently and reading. And, you know, the Romans called this the phatry, which was like the stage between, a group of family. We call it family friends. I wonder if the etymology is similar, the idea of friends coming from phratry. But this idea that you build community with the people that you're closest to in terms of values and manners and race and identity and stuff like this. And then your children grow up together instead of going to these big giant, industrial schools. And this localism creates a sense of strong community because you're actually related to each other. Your children, like the idea of a proper community and where white people are doing things wrong is who are you making children with is obviously the most important decision you have to make in your life. Who is your life partner in that sense? But the second most important decision from a genetic perspective is who are your friends? Who are your closest friends? Because in theory, in a wholesome society, your kids are growing up together. And, what happens when they're teenagers? What happens when they're in their early 20s? And your families are that close. You go to church together or you celebrate, intrinsic Aryan celebrations together. Who are you having Christmas with? Who are you having Easter with? Who are you having Yule with? Who are you having Midsummer with? Or are your kids just part of the great liberal democracy experiment and going to fucking Mardi Gras, and getting lost in the abyss? Are they going to Mardi Gras or are they having Midsummer in your little community? And, that's the foundation of the phatry, which is the extended family, which is all your family friends. And then me, and if me and Mark lived in the same area in England, for example, or if Mark lived in Australia and we were mates and he's got a wife and he's got kids and I've got a wife and I've got kids, fast forward 20, 30 years, our kids are hanging out, his sons and my daughters, my sons and his daughters. At some point, me and Mark are going to be like, we're going to share grandchildren. And no one thinks like this, that your friends are actually, like when you're old men, the men you're surrounding yourself with in theory aren't your friends. They're actually your co-grandparenting together and co-great-grandparenting together. And this is where political strength comes from. And a lot of people don't realize this. This is why the community building element, and they're going to call us a cult. Of course, they're going to call us a cult, but they're all doing it. They're all strengthening those intergenerational marriage ties in the blood. They're all doing it. Now, we don't want to inbreed. We don't want people marrying their first cousins. But Mark and I aren't first cousins. Our children aren't going to get sick if they hang out together. They're not going to come out demented like, Mark, we'll be careful. Don't say a specific race. It could be vilification.
Oh, no, you absolutely can in this case. There's a big problem with the Pakistani Muslim community inbreeding to the point where there are special, in certain parts of the country like Bradford, there are special sort of leaflets on the wall in hospitals saying, do not marry your first cousin.
Yeah. And I mean, they're retarded to start with. So I'm not even going to go down that train of thought, but this is where the basic root of political power comes from within a democracy. Within a different kind of order, it comes from a martial culture. And I think that we should have a healthy balance between the feminine and the masculine, between Venus and Mars, between the community building and the political brotherhood, the order. There is an order, there is a hierarchy, there is a masculine institution that builds a brotherhood of men in common identity, in common ideas, ideation. That has to be balanced, of course, with the community building side of things and building those strong bonds. And what stronger bond do you have with people? And this is endemic. So if we want to talk about what's happening in South Africa, or we want to talk about what's happening in Australia, or we want to talk about what's happening with the grooming gangs in England, for example, where a community can survive things like these grooming gang attacks is about accountability and responsibility. And the people that were affected by the grooming gangs in England, I'm just making a generalization here, were people that were communityless. They were people that were in weak, isolated, disadvantaged, small families, or no family at all. They were wards of the state, and they are the vulnerable people. They are vulnerable, and they're vulnerable because that doesn't happen. And I've done this rant a couple times, and it's not actually to do with this topic. It's to do with politics in general, and it was actually to do with COVID, was how it was raised to me. I was working on a farm, and I was building an old guy a shed. I was putting a roof on his shed as part of my work as a laborer. And this old guy came over to me. He was 73 years old. His great-grandfather purchased that farm from the Crown prior to Federation, so pre-1901. And his family has lived on this farm the whole existence that Australia has existed. And he said to me, do you know why they did that COVID thing to you? You know how they got all you guys locked up and how they got you all bundled up and all that shit they forced on people? You know how they did it? And then he said, when I was your age, there was six families here. I'm the last one left. I'm the only one left on my land. All the rest have been bought up and pushed out by the local government through taxation and everything else and the property developers. I'm the only one left. But when I was your age, there was six families here. And I came from the smallest family. There was only seven or eight of us. But the McMillans had 14 and the Jeffersons had 12. And he's pointing at all these farms. And he's saying that if a police officer did that, or if a man did that to any one of their sisters, you know, because there was videos coming out in Australia where police officers were choking young girls and pushing them up against walls because they were wearing, because they weren't wearing a mask. And you had, you know, these 50-year-old fat, disgusting cops choking young women up against walls because they're not wearing a mask. And what he said was that wouldn't have happened in my day because they would have had 150 men knocking on the police officer's door. There would have been the McMillans would have been like, that's our sister. The Jeffersons would have been like, that's my sister-in-law. You know, this family over here would have been. And so the men in the community would have held that to account at a local level. Every local community would have held people to account at the local level. And because there is the concept that would happen, and the other thing was the police officer would have been from that community. So how the system has done this to us is it has alienated and isolated us. And so then it can pick us off through a bureaucracy, through a cobweb of lies and traitors and evil people that can't be held accountable. And I'm not talking in a dangerous way, Mark, but you mentioned before about the groomers. They don't feel ashamed of going to jail, but they feel shame losing their house. Likewise, shame is a very powerful motivating tool. Who is shaming these police officers? No one's shaming them. If they lived in a community and they behaved that way, they would be ostracized by everyone. No one would ever talk to that family ever again. The family itself would kick that police officer and disown them from the family, disown them from their inheritance because of the shame they brought on the whole community. And the last thing this old man said to me was, they wouldn't be able to do that to us because back in my day, we were a clan. We were a clan, which is a phatry. We were a phatry. We were a powerful political entity of family friends, of patriarchs that had big families. That is the building block of power. If you're not doing that, you're a fucking idiot. If you're going off into the woods by yourself with you and your wife and two kids, you're a fucking moron. All right? You need to build phatries. That is the building block of power. We need to tribe and train. And then from phatries, there's another step again. But again, the man and the woman are the building block. Then the next building block is the family, then the extended family, the intergenerational family, having resources, having land, having the ability to sustain multiple sons, getting married, staying on the land or staying as close as possible so that you're not atomized and alienated and isolated. You are congregating, you are strong, you are together, you're holding ground in an area, wherever that can be. And then your mates live around the corner or down the street, and he's doing the same thing. And he's doing the same thing. And if there's six of you or 10 of you over 50 years, there could be a couple hundred of you. And then you can ally with other groups of a couple hundred. And now you have political power. This is how the Muslims can mobilize so many tens of thousands out of the mosque, for example. So this is how white people need to treat the building block of democracy. We can't survive in democracy if we're not doing this. It leaves only the other option, which we won't discuss, will we? Not yet.
Well, thank you. George Floyd Creepy Pasta gave $5. And this is a long question, but if we can try and keep it as short as possible, he says, a question for Tom. Do you need to be a Christian to be a National Socialist?
Well, I can keep that one really short. The answer is no. I'm not a Christian. Okay. Why would you? To me, that's an offensive question. Why would you need to be Christian to be a National Socialist?
I don't know. I mean, I think, I think the sort of National Socialist ideology applies to or can be applied to any racial or ethnic group. And during the Second World War, there were numerous different racial or ethnic groups and religious groups that all subscribed to that ideology. So I
but
don't
also
think
about a third of the SS were considered non-denomination, which meant that they weren't Christians. They were God-believing non-denomination. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
About a third. And I would argue that that's probably a similar demographic that has always been within National Socialism in the 20th and 21st century. So okay. I am God believing.
One last question from Jagdeep Jaino, who gave $5. Thanks so much. Can Tom please detail the difference between Caramel Island and Chocolate Island? I don't know what this means.
yes, I can. So I made a joke. Because there's another guy in the Australian Parliament called Babbitt, Senator Babbitt. And he says similar talking points to this Senator Rennick. He's blown up on social media. He's got a huge following and he's got a lot of basic takes that are pretty funny and in line with the total governance of the worldview. But obviously he's caramel. He's Mauritian. He's from Mauritius. And they're kind of like a mixed race bunch, a caramel bunch. You wouldn't call him an Indian. You wouldn't call him an African. But he's certainly not white. He's not even close. So we would racially designate that as caramel to some extent. And what I said as a joke, which I'm still serious about, was that Babbitt, for all his benefits to the Australian Parliament, he's not actually Australian. He wants to be Australian, and he thinks he can be Australian. And if people like me lose, then I guess then Australia will turn into Caramel Island. And, he will be Australian in that future Caramel Island where people like me don't exist. But I have a strong feeling that we're going to win, that it's not going to be a Caramel Island, that it's going to be a white island. And because Babbitt has done such a great service to white people, he's not anti-white. He's one of the only politicians in Parliament that's not white. He's one of these kind of tokens that does all of the pro-white talking points. And he's allowed to. He gets away with it because he's not white. What I said as a joke was that, when we win, he's the last one to get deported because of his great service. And he's getting deported first class. And we're going to get him a private jet and an island. And he's going to go on the Bronze Power jet to Caramel Island. And he's going to get all the caramel honeys that we deport because that might distract the white nationalist operation if we leave the caramel honeys. And all the caramel honeys are going to get deported to Caramel Island, and Babbitt's going to have the caramel honeys on Caramel Island, and he can run his harem, and he'll say, thank you, Mr. Thomas Sewell. Thank you for building me a big house on the Caramel Island. I hope you enjoy the big house on White Island. And I'll say, good fences make good neighbors. It is what it is. And, I wouldn't call him an ally, but as I said, I think that's a good deal. I think that's the deal. If he's nice to us, we'll be nice to him, and then we can part ways when the mission's done. What Chocolate Island is that the joke was that obviously Africa is Chocolate Island and like it's a shithole because it's full of Africans. But you could run like an experiment where you make an island full of all the like house Negroes, like Deng Powell and Kanye West.
Yeah, we can't use that term in this country. That's a jailable term.
Which one? Oh, sorry, I don't want to
say. N-word is a jailable term, Tom. We're getting towards the end of the stream anyway. Right. We might be getting a bit exuberant.
Okay,
we have
all right.
to get off to the wife and baby in a second.
The difference is pretty clear. It's like you have white people, you have spicy white people, you have caramel people, and then you have chocolate and black people. And that's just a basic, you know, that's an easy racial classification everyone can understand. Everyone's got a slightly different version of what they define as spicy white. Is Nick Fuentes spicy white? Who knows? You know, everyone's got their own classification. But yeah, I'll leave it there.
We have run over time, and I have just had a text from the wife about being needed on baby duty. So I'm gonna have to get off in a second. I've had my son arrive just over 2 weeks ago. So we're too deep now, the same as you guys. But yeah, it's a shame we aren't neighbours. Our kids would love playing together. Anyway, it's been a really, really enjoyable show. Tom's been amazing tonight and a really good sport. I'd love to do a film review with you, and I will be in touch about that shortly. But do you have any final thoughts very quickly before we shut things down?
Vitality. That's what we need. Vitality. Aesthetics and vitality. If we can get that right, we're going to win. So that's the focus.
Well, thank you so much, Thomas. It's been an amazing show tonight. I'd just like to thank everybody who took part. Biggest thanks, of course, goes to Thomas. Massive thanks to everyone who donated so generously. I will be back later in the week with Joel Davis on Sunday talking about whether National Socialism can be resurrected. He argues yes. Keith argues no. I wanted them to debate each other. That would have been far more entertaining, but instead he's just talking to me, and I'll probably try and argue some of the points just from a devil's advocate point of view. That'll be Sunday night. Got a video out on Friday, and I'll be back same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. As always, thank you to everyone who donated. Thanks, massive thanks to Thomas. It's been an amazing show. But the biggest thanks always goes out to this amazing community. I love you all. Stay strong, keep fighting. I'll see you all same time next week. Thank you and good night.